Hello, and welcome to the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with the various playwrights of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato, and for the next half hour or so, we'll be speaking with Texas playwright Bradley Neese about his experience with the Texas University Interscholastic League, his love for using the city of Houston as a backdrop for many of his plays, as well as the appeal for crafting plays based on true crime. Bradley, hello, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, how are you doing?
No, I'm doing great, and great. And you know, school is about to start, and I know that you are a very busy man. You teach down at Blinn College, I believe, and I know that classes are about to get underway. So we are recording this Labor Day weekend, so I really appreciate you taking time out of your Labor Day weekend to speak with us for a few minutes.
No problem.
All right. Great. Well, I always like to start these things off by, anyone listening to these things, they know by now that I'm like, the whole purpose of this podcast series is to try to take writers that, the general theater masses may not have heard of, we'll put yet out there, because I know for sure that, obviously by the time of this, we're all going to be so popular. But I want to get out there, and I want to introduce some folks to writers and stuff that they haven't heard of yet. So I'm just going to start right out of the gate by asking you to just tell the world out there, give a little bit of history about Bradley Neese.
Sure. Well, I live here in Brenham, Texas, which is about 45 minutes away from Houston. I was raised all over the place. I was an Army brat for the first few years of my life, and then my father was a business owner, and he was constantly moving us. So I've lived all over the place, up in Chicago, up in northern Texas, southern Texas, down through here, and I became the theater arts director at Blinn College in Brenham in 1990. So I have been there for a few years.
Oh, wow. You've been there quite a while.
Yes.
All right. Well, speaking of that, since, I think that I'm trying to think here on this, as far as college goes, you're the first college professor that we've had on here. So I think we might as well just have you go ahead and give a plug out to your school there. Tell us a little bit about the theater department there at Blinn.
Sure. We have a two-year comprehensive program that we're very, very proud of at Blinn College in Brenham. We house approximately, I would say, around 40 students, 40 to 50 students per year, and we produce at least four shows a year. We do two in the fall, two in the spring, and then we do we have a improv troupe called Slap Happy, and they do performances. On top of that, we also bring in outside events through what we call the Performing Arts Series. And what this is these are professional companies that can come in and perform in our facility, and our students get the experience of working behind the scenes with those companies. Then we also do some community things. We've got a couple of community organizations that use our facility. We have the Brenham Children's Chorus and the Brenham Broadway Kids. They come in and they perform, and our students get to work behind the scenes with that as well. So not only are our students getting experiences on stage, they're getting experience backstage, and they're getting to actually work with professional companies.
Oh, wow, that's a wonderful program out there that you guys have got going there. That's kind of a unique experience. When a school brings professionals in order to work, so your students actually get quite a leg up before they get out actually into the theatrical world, huh?
Yes, they certainly do. We also have a program in the Bryan campus. We have a theater arts program in Brenham and in Bryan. The Bryan campus hosts a plethora of different shows through the year, and they also do just phenomenal work. The work that they do over there is just absolutely incredible. But yes, I'm on the Brenham campus, but the Bryan campus is also doing some great theater. So you've got both two theater programs producing really good theater out of Blinn College.
I do know from being from South Texas myself that there are no shortage of absolutely wonderful theatrical programs going on around the state. Texas, you know, a lot of people that don't know a lot of just what's going on theatrically. You know, Texas is known for its athletics, across the board, you know, just with football and all of that stuff. But there is just a multitude of theater programs around the Lone Star State. So I appreciate that. That's wonderful stuff. Speaking of that, as we go in, you have been a part of UIL in the past. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. I am a very large supporter of the University Interscholastic League here in Texas, as well as TETA, that stands for the Texas Educational Theater Association.
All right. So we, in the last podcast, we spoke to Amanda Bishop Guthrie about UIL and her experience. And that's it's a very unique sort of play competition that, to be honest, I wish other states would adopt something like that, because that is, it's huge. It's statewide. How long have you been involved over the years in UIL, and what's been your experience with them over the years?
Sure. I started in high school. I was a freshman in high school, and I was in a production of The Rude Mechanicals, which is an adaptation of A Midsummer Night's Dream, and that was my first experience with UIL one-act play way back in the 80s and early 80s. And so I've been some way involved with it ever since then. After high school, I went to college and ended up assisting the theater director at Amarillo College in the one-act play contest that they would host. So I was helping with those. When I went on to West Texas State University, which is now, as you may know, West Texas A&M, West Texas, I would assist with UIL events as well. There, I did a little bit more. I changed my major from theater to radio TV, so I was doing a little bit more of the speaking events and things like that, but I was still heavily involved. I took my job in Brenham, and immediately I became the contest manager for the regional one-act play for 1As and for 3As, and for our area, and so I've been contest managing for many, many years. Here recently, I've been judging regional contests. So we've hired on someone to come in and do those and run those regional contests, manage those regional contests. I've been a judge ever since about 1995. I've been a judge for UIL. I've been adjudicating shows. I've been on several committees through the Texas Educational Theater Association. We are institutional members, which means that we are allowed to have a booth at the conference, and we do a lot of things through TETA, using TETA as support, and made a lot of great friends. It's a really exceptional experience. Like you, I really wish that other states would get it. I think they would benefit from it.
Now, you jog my memory on something right there. TETA has, they have the Texas Educational Theater Association. They have two events in Texas each year, don't they? They have one that's kind of in the summer, and then they have one that's in the winter. Isn't one of them down in Galveston, like near Moody Gardens?
It was in Galveston for the last 2 years. It's going to be in Addison, which is close to Dallas, this year. And they're moving it. It normally was in January, but now they're moving it to September because it's a little easier for students to still get scholarships. Because students can come to this as high school students can come, and they can audition for, if they're seniors, they can audition for scholarships from universities. And these and these scholarships are going to be more available to them at the beginning of the year versus midway through the year. So they're looking at that, plus some other details. They've decided it would be beneficial to move it from January to September. The other one you're talking about is their Summerfest, and Blinn College just hosted this this summer, hosted the Summerfest that happens in June, and that's more for educators. And there's workshops, and there's fun things to do, and it was a great experience. I'd never done fun Summerfest before, and just had a lot of fun with it. In fact, I told our dean that I intend to go to the Summerfest from here on out, just because it was just a lot of fun being there.
Okay, well, there you go. Anyone that is listening to this from outside of Texas, see what you're missing out on as far as theater, because there's an awful lot going on the high school level and the college level. I want to give out one other thing on UIL, and then we'll move on and talk about some of your other works. You were a judge this past year, and I understand that just as luck would have it, Next Stage Press has been slowly having plays and stuff that have been introduced into UIL, and they've been approved for contest use. And you actually saw one of our plays for the very first time. You were at one of the I think you were a judge, or you were one of the ones where Child's Play was had its first entrance or something. It was going on at regionals, I believe, this go around. Is that true?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I was really excited because as an adjudicator, I would say it was one of these cases. Normally we have panels of adjudicators, but this is one case where I was a single judge. And I saw, when I got the script, I thought, oh, Next Stage Press. They just did a great job with it. I mean, there was no question. The acting was real. The story was well told. And the script was very well written. I believe trying to remember, I've slept since then, but
right.
I believe they had to cut it. I think it was a full-length play that they cut down, and their cutting was really, really, really good. So I was very excited to see Next Stage Press being represented very well.
Now, see there, now you see what I did right there? I just put this thing in there now to where Kevin D. Ferguson, who is the playwright of Child's Play, is he's going to have no choice but to have to share this podcast before it's over with everyone that he knows. All right, so let's get on to your work. Because there is, you have been doing a lot of exciting work that's been coming down here, and you are not from Houston. That is correct. Am I correct in that?
Yes and no. Like I said before, I moved around all while I was growing up. We lived in Houston during my formative years. We lived in Houston from the ages I was from 3 to 8. Is when we lived in Houston, Texas, and so there's a lot of things about it that I remember, because that's where you're figuring things out and learning things and everything. There's a lot of things I remember, and one of the things I remember is whenever something really bad would happen, people would be talking about it. It became news. It was all in people were talking about it in the news, on TV. Every time something really, really shocking happened. I remember those because I remember they touched me. They said, oh, wow, I can't believe this is actually happening in our real world. But yes, I did live in Houston for a stint. I didn't live there I didn't move back to the area until 1990 when I took my job at Blinn.
Okay, so that because as a native Houstonian myself, I'm always you read a gazillion plays, and Houston is not normally what you would call a usual setting that people think of whenever they're choosing a location for their stories. I mean, you see plays all the time that take place in New York, or they take place in Chicago, or these small towns all over the place. But Houston's a major metropolitan area, and you have repeatedly gone back to Houston as a location. So what's the drive in choosing Houston as a setting for some of your plays?
Well, I'll tell you. We moving here in 1990, I realized that Houston I was living. I was working at Blinn College for a couple of years as theater director, and everybody talked about, oh, the big scary city, because we're about, like I said, we're about 45 minutes away, 45 minutes to an hour away from Houston, and people talked about the big bad city. And I realized after a couple of years of working at Blinn that Houston has the second largest theater district in the United States. New York is number one. Houston's number two. They do it by the number of seats that are in the theater district. And, of course, New York City has the most number. Houston's number two. Chicago's number three, which kind of surprised me. I thought Chicago would be number two. But they're almost, they have almost as many seats as Houston does, but not quite as many. So I thought to myself, as a theater director, that's nuts that I'm not embracing this more than what I am with my students. So therefore, we started going into Houston and going to see plays and starting to see things and really promoting the fact that, hey, guys, with a stone's throw, we are close to the second largest theater district in the United States. And so I really started promoting that. Well, my family and I got to where we would go into Houston, do things and have fun and stay in the, you know, it's a large city, so you have to be careful. But
sure.
In the safe parts, you know, and everything. And we enjoyed going to Galveston. We love going down to Galveston right there, you know, south of Houston, and enjoying ourselves. Well, it was in one of these trips, I remember looking around and realizing, you know, horrible things happen everywhere in large cities, you know, not just New York or not just Chicago, where you hear where a lot of plays are based. I mean, here we are, and there's a lot of things. There's a lot of stories in this area that could be told. And then I got to being interested in the macabre and being interested in horror movies and things along that lines. I did a little research on Houston and found out that there is an entire dark history of Houston that a lot of people don't know about. And they think it's just Houston. It's a big city. It's down here in the South. You know, that's it. But we're all about oil and gas and cattle. And, I mean, there are some really spooky stories that come out of that city. And there's some that come out of Galveston. And I thought to myself, I really need to hone in on this. I really need to embrace this, because being a lover of horror, I thought that would be a good thing. Then I even found that I could take some of these horror stories, and because of some of the crazy people that I've met since being down in this part of Texas, I could actually make some of these stories humorous. They're dark humor, but I could make some of the stories kind of funny too. So that's why I embrace Houston. And again, it was my formative years when I was living there, and I enjoy remembering the, you know, some of these things. I remember when some of these major events happened.
Well, the reason I bring this up, and we're about to you know, I'm glad that you brought up the whole horrific underbelly, because we're about to get to your here in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about your play, The Boys from Houston Heights. But the first play that you had published with us was a collection of one acts, which was Minor Inconveniences and Perfect Mother, and both of them are set in Houston. And we also can announce on this podcast, very excited, that October 1st, you have a farce that will probably be very popular around Halloween called Haunting the House, which is also uses Houston as a locale. So after we talk about The Boys from Houston Heights, I want you to tell everyone about Haunting the House and what they can expect from that. But let's get to one of the most shocking plays that I've read in a while, and I'm gonna go into this and tell you the we published your play The Boys from Houston Heights not long ago, and I grew up in the Heights. My great grandmother's house was about three or four blocks from where that incident happened. If you have not read anyone listening to this podcast, if you have not read The Boys from Houston Heights, get yourself a copy of it, and you can go on YouTube, because there is a story of Dean Corll, I think I'm pronouncing his name right on that, who was the serial killer that was a killer of young boys in the late 60s to early 70s, and was just, it was just an absolutely horrific story. So I'm going to ask you, Bradley, what was it about that story that really drew you to it?
Well, like I said, when we lived in Houston, there were some major stories that happened in the early 70s that I remember happening. I remember when, I can't remember his name, but there was a guy and he was on drugs and he drove through a neighborhood, and it was a very upscale neighborhood in Houston, because I can remember when I was little, there were neighborhoods where things like this just didn't happen in it. And he was shooting people from his car. And he ended up killing 3 or 4 people. It was something like that. And I remember that story. I remember hearing about Ronald O'Brien, who was the candy man, the one who had poisoned his children's candy at Halloween and claimed that somebody had done it, you know, door to door.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember that story.
I remember they were talking about, and Halloween's my favorite holiday, so I was very upset
right.
when they were saying about canceling Halloween. I was
right.
like, I don't think so. But I remember that, and I remember them talking about a guy named Dean Corll. And I didn't understand, because I was little, and they didn't tell me, just my parents didn't want to tell me too much about it, but I just knew that he had done some bad things. Well, after moving back to this area, I was kind of like, whatever happened with that story? I don't remember that. So I looked it up, and sure enough, you were absolutely right. He was, at that time, considered, this was 1973, he was considered the most prolific serial killer at that time. They found 27 dead bodies of boys that he had murdered in the Houston, from the Houston Heights area and from other parts of Houston. And he, before John Wayne Gacy was arrested and convicted of serial killing, he was the most prolific at that time. So in researching and reading about him and doing things along that lines, I realized a lot of people just, they may remember him, but they don't, you don't hear about him. Not like John Wayne Gacy, or not like Jeffrey Dahmer. You don't hear about him. He's not one of the ones that just automatically, when you think serial killers, Ted Bundy. You don't think of Dean Corll. But I mean, he has a place in the scary underbelly of Houston. And I believe that by not remembering opens us up for it happening again. And so that's why we have to be educated and aware that these things do happen. And when the man tries to give you candy, don't take it. there's a reason why we're not supposed to take candy and climb into their vans, because things happen. So yeah, I wrote that, and with that in mind, another thing that I was really proud of that play, Gene, because that was the first time I got out of my comfort zone as a writer. I was writing plays, and they were cute little stories and everything. They were, you know, things that you could read about and all this, and it was all good, but I wanted to, there was a contest that they were offering at the Queensbury Theater in Houston, and I wanted to enter a play in that, and I thought, okay, if I'm going to write about Dean Corll, I'm going to have to get real. I'm going to have to go into a world that I don't associate with on a regular basis, the world of a serial killer, and get into his mind and try and figure out why he would, if I'm going to recreate this character, why, you know, how did he think? So I did. I researched and I interviewed people, and I went into, I told my wife at the time, I was researching on the computer. I said, "Don't look at the history of our computer," because I mean I was looking up Houston male prostitutes in Houston, because that was a big part of what it was about.
Sure.
I was looking up serial killers, you know, trying to understand the minds of one, and so I was particularly proud of that, because for the first time as a playwright, I was out of my comfort zone. I was dealing with things that I'm writing about things that were that are horrible. And you hear stories, kind of like the Titanic. You know, you hear, for years we heard about the Titanic. It's this big ship that sunk. But when you see the movie and see what the people went through, all of a sudden there's a whole new layer that we never considered. And I think that's what that play did for me.
Well, if
it showed me a whole new layer. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I mean, Dean Corll, he also was he was well liked in the Heights, and didn't he help look for some of the victims that he had killed?
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. He was he had a business in the Heights, and he was real well known by people. He was loved by children. He gave free candy out of his store to children, and so that was. Everybody knew him and everyone liked him, and he was the kind he would, if a kid didn't have a father, he would kind of take him in and be kind of a father figure. And then after a while, the kid disappeared. So, you know, it was, yes, you're absolutely right. Nobody ever suspected that somebody like him would have done something like that. Kind of like, Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, nobody would suspect that this guy would do something that would change the 1960s. Well, nobody suspected that the guy running the candy shop down the street was doing anything either, but he was.
Right. And my understanding was, there was a boat storage facility down in Pasadena that he buried a lot of the bodies in, if I remember correctly on that.
Yes. Yes, you're right. In fact, I'll tell you something that's been real interesting since I've written this. I sent it to the Queensberry Theater, and it became a finalist for one of their series of reading plays. So the Dirt Dogs Theater in Houston they had the Dirt Dog Theater come into the Queensberry Theater, and they did a staged reading of it. And this did a great job with it. I got to see it fleshed out. I got a wonderful experience with them. It was awesome. And I was really cool. Now, it wasn't selected as part of their season, but that's okay, because it still made a finalist. I was so proud of that play, and just really honored that they thought it was something that needed, that there was a story that needed to be told.
Well, it was good that you got out of your comfort zone on that. Now, you recently posted a blog about true crime stories on stage. And we see true crime on television all the time, but not necessarily in theater. Why are you so intrigued by true crime stories? And do you think that we'll start to see more of them as plays like this come out?
Well, I hope so. Because the reason I'm intrigued by them is because I've always liked scary stuff, and I think I've always liked scary movies and dark stories, and I think that when you hear it's based on a real story, all of a sudden there's a whole new layer of fear that goes with it. It's not like Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees. They're not, you know, it's like you kill them, then they get back up and come back, you know.
Right.
Well, then you say, okay, well, this, you know, okay, that doesn't happen. You know, that can't, this isn't true. But when you hear this is based on true story, it's about real people, I think that's another layer of the fact that, you know, hey, the person next door to me could be doing this, and I don't even realize it. And so I just think it's even scarier when it's based on something real. It becomes more real. Toby Hooper, was the director of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, Toby Hooper, yeah.
He loosely based his movie on Ed Gein, who was up in Wisconsin, but he claimed to make the movie scarier, claimed that it happened in, I think it was, Clarendon, Texas. Well, see, I'm from, I went to high school up around Clarendon, Texas. I know that area. And I was like, wait a minute, this didn't happen in Clarendon, did it?
Right.
You know? And, but what does it do? It makes people go, oh, wait a minute, I know where Clarendon is. I live over that area. I think it, oh my gosh, I didn't know, you know. Then all of a sudden it becomes creepier, it becomes scarier.
Right, when you're driving through there in the middle of the night, just a little bit of the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, even though it didn't actually happen there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But one thing I did find that when I was writing this, I had a lot of people would tell me, I've had a cousin who was murdered by Dean Corll. And I'm just like going, wow, it really, it happened. A lot of people forgot about it, but there's people that remember it.
Sure.
You said about the boat storage. I was working in a play last summer, as a matter of fact, with a gentleman, and I had told the company, I said, this time you had contacted me about publishing the play, and I was real proud, and I told him, I said, that I told my students, I said, this is going to be a play that may get published here. And I had a gentleman from the community, an older gentleman who was in the play, and he came up to me after the play, and he said, you want to know something? He said his car was stolen in 1973. He said, we found it in a boat storage. The person had stolen it and had hidden it in a boat storage in Houston, in South Houston.
Oh, wow.
And he said the next day was when they found out about Dean Corll, and they opened up that boat storage right next to where his car was. And that's where all those boys were.
Oh, my gosh.
And he said, I never forgot that. I was there the day before that whole thing exploded. And so you hear these things, and it's like it really did affect people, and you see how it affected them. So it's just interesting. I think that's interesting.
It is interesting. All right, well, we'll change gears here and lighten the mood on this, because the Boys from Houston Heights is such a positive way, a wonderfully horrific thing to endure. But let's talk a little bit about your play that's about to be published, Haunting the House. That we're kind of back up in the land of farce right here. So quickly, because we're coming up on time here, but let's tell everyone a little bit about Haunting the House.
Well, it's also based loosely on a true story. There was a family back in the 1930s that lived in England, actually, and they were trying to convince people that their house was haunted. They were trying to do this because there was a gentleman that from London who would, if they could convince him that the house was haunted, then he would come in, write a book about their house, and possibly get some money for them. That was their whole plan. So this family concocted this scheme to haunt their house, is what they were doing. And they did all these crazy, ridiculous things trying to make this guy believe it. And unfortunately, fortunately for them, the guy was kind of a dingling, and he believed it. He believed this house was haunted, and he wrote this book, and he tried, but unfortunately for them, they did not get any money from the book. He kept all the money, but they just knew they were going to become wealthy because this was going to make them famous. Well, it made the story became famous. They, you know, fell into the cracks of it. So what I did is I had always thought that's kind of a humor. You know, when you think of, you hear about, you know, this house is supposed to be haunted, it's a neat story to think about. But it's the fact that these people were trying to make this work and doing these outrageous things. They had their children hiding in the walls of the house and making sounds when he'd come over, because they were trying to get they figured out ways to make the piano play by itself. They did all these crazy things trying to get them. And I thought that would just be that could be a funny story. So I put it in Houston because I love Houston, and it's about a woman who thinks her house is haunted, and there is a Rice University professor who has to get so many things published a year. And so what he's decided, because paranormal studies are really hip and cool and everybody loves them, he's decided he's going to write a paranormal book about her haunted house. And she's very excited because now she's going to have validity that when she tells people her house is haunted, they just don't think she's a crazy old lady. And professor is excited because he's going to be able to keep his job, and it's going to be great. And he's going to get some coin as well, and he's excited. He and his wife are excited about that. And then they find the only psychic that they can find in Houston is an animal communicator who speaks to deceased animals, and that is a real thing. If you look it up, you can see in Houston that's kind of the hip, cool thing right now is people talking to their dead animals and having seances with their cats and dogs.
I,
and
I really did not know that that was that's a thing that's going on in Houston. Really?
Yes. If you, I heard the first time I heard it was on satellite radio. There's a pet psychic, and she will listen to your when you call her, she will tell you what Fluffy's thinking from beyond the grave. And so I thought that's hysterical. So I put in a, no offense to anyone who believes in that, but it's still hysterical.
I don't know, but you just came up with a great title for another another farce to write called Fluffy Beyond the Grave. I don't see how anyone could not write a play called Fluffy Beyond the Grave.
Fluffy Beyond the Grave. Yes, I agree. But anyway, they get this animal communicator to come to their house, and they're going to have a validation. They're going to have a séance. And it just turns into this misunderstood. Of course, it's a farce, so it's got misunderstandings and people running from room to room. And I like to call it noises off in a haunted house. Because that's what it's like, the play Noises Off, with slamming doors and a whole bunch of characters misunderstanding each other and getting confused. So it's a lot of fun. I'm proud of that one too. That was a finalist for a contest. Again, it wasn't selected, but it was a finalist for the Theater Victoria in Victoria, Texas.
Wow. All right. Well, there you go. So that's a recap there of Haunting the House, which is going to be published October the 1st, just in time, of course, for the month of Halloween to get here. Okay, a couple more things here. Are you currently working on another play that we can be looking forward to? Or if so, what can you tell us about it? Or has school got you going on full time right now?
Well, yes and yes. School's got me going full time, but I try to spend a couple of hours every day writing, because if I don't do it, then I'll get busy on other things. So whenever I come in from rehearsals in the evening, I usually sit down for a couple of hours and sit and will write. I'm right now working on a play, which is the working title of it is called Dead as the Dodo, and it's a British farce. It's again loosely based on a true story about a woman who her sister passed away, and she did not want to deal with the fact that her sister had passed away, and so she just pretended that her sister was still alive. And this really did happen in the United States, and so it was it's the basis. I put it in England because I thought, oh, this might be a good English story, and been researching English and trying to get all these things going this way. And originally I was going to set it in Texas, in a part of in South Texas here, but I don't know. It kind of kept going in a British farce style, and so I'm working on that right now and trying to get that going. I also have a family story of my own. My great great grandmother on my father's side, it turned out, we found this out, oh, I'd say about 10 to 20 years ago, she murdered her husband with an axe. She decided that she was tired of him, so she hacked him to with an axe. And maybe this is why I'm so warped. She did that back in 1910, and so I've been working on a script with that. But that's one of those ones that I have to keep going back to, because I keep going into it and saying, how am I going to tell this story and not just completely, blow it way out of proportion, because I'm real bad about doing that sometimes. And trying to keep it real and trying to keep – and the information, all the research I can find have just been newspaper clippings, which have told me a good little bit of the story. And a gentleman did write a book about it called Nellie Niffin Took an Axe. And that's a book that he wrote about that murder. And I'm trying to do it without making it based on his book. Been just using that as research and everything. But it's a little close. That's really close to home. That'll be another. I'll just have to finally buckle down and sit down and just finish that thing. And that'll be, like I said, another another out of my comfort zone, because that deals with my family.
Right, right.
I had to kind of tiptoe around my family and say, listen, I'm going to write this play, and it's going to be about my great-great-grandmother who killed people, and my brother's mortified, and other people are just like, oh, you're not going to tell this story, are you? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell this story. I just haven't figured out exactly how I'm going to do it. But that's one of those projects I keep coming back to. Occasionally.
Well, I just realized that when we were talking about UIL, there was one of your works that's published by Next Stage Press. You would think that I would get the company name right whenever I'm saying this right. Next Stage Press, that we kind of forgot to talk about that was put in there. You did an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart. What can you tell us about that, and what brought you to do an adaptation?
I did the Telltale Heart for a class I was taking. I was taking professional development courses at Texas Tech. I was doing them online or long distance. And I did a playwriting class with this professor who was just incredible, Dr. Burt, Dr. Norman Burt. And he was phenomenal. And what I did is I told him when I started this class, he said, what would you like to write about? And I said, you know, I know that there are some stage versions of the Telltale Heart, but I want to do one that takes it completely from a female perspective. I want to show what it would be if instead the narrator being a man, because it's usually read by a man or given the idea that it's a man, what if this was a woman? And what if she was driven to the point of killing someone? So I put a whole backstory with it, made it her father that's with the eye that's driving her crazy, put it in an asylum, like she's telling her story. And when I got done, he was just like, "Hey, this thing could really he thought it could really sell." And so that's when I contacted you, as a matter of fact, and said, This is a play I've written. Do you think you might be interested? And you were. So it was that's what that's about. And that's a one act, and it has been told is going on the approved list for UIL one act plays. That is going to be going on the approved list this year. Now I have been checking online, hadn't seen it come up yet, but they told me last January that this coming school year it was going to go on the approved list.
All right, fantastic. Well, hopefully we can get some schools and other theater companies as well, if you're interested in doing a one act that has a little bit of name recognition to it with Edgar Allan Poe, then by all means, check it out. Okay, one last question for you. How can people follow your writing adventures? Are you on social media?
I do have a little bit of social media out there, but I'm a kind of face-to-face kind of guy. I don't do just tons of, I don't have a ton of different social media contacts. I do have a Facebook page, which is two, actually. I've got one, Brad Niece, which is, that's the name I go by professionally at work, is just, you know, Mr. Brad Niece. And then there is one, Bradley Niece Playwright. When I write, I use the whole Bradley. And that's another one. And I post things out there about, hey, guys, I've got this published, or hey, I'm working on this, or hey, doing things like that. So you can certainly check me out at Facebook. I also have a blog. If you go to Bradley Niece, BradleyNiece Playwright, all together, at blogspot.com, you can go to my blog, and there I try for at least a couple of months, try to update with new stories, with various things. That's where I do a little research, and I ask myself how many plays are based on real crimes and things like that, and get some conversation going. And again, you know, when I put out there, hey, I wrote this play about this and this and this, I'll get people every once in a while, if it's real, that will contact me and say, I remember when that happened. I remember when that happened, and I remember how devastating that was for people. So it's nice to know that people are reminded of it, and that I'm doing my job in helping us keep from having that happen again.
Well, that is Bradley. Thank you so much for taking a little bit of time to talk with us again. Really appreciate having you on, and it'll be interesting to look forward and see what's going to be coming out with you in the future.
Great. I thoroughly enjoyed this, Gene. Thank you so very much for this opportunity.
All right. That's all the time we have for this episode. If you'd like to purchase any of Bradley's plays, they are available on Amazon.com, and you can read the first half of his plays or any of Next Stage Press's works on our website at www.nextstagepress.net. Also, if you're hearing this podcast for the first time, you can find other episodes on iTunes or Podomatic, and now on Spotify. Just search Next Stage Press and hit subscribe, and as always, they're free to listen to, and feel free to share them with the world through the wonderful marvel of social media, and please leave us a review so that we can keep bringing you the types of podcasts that you want to hear. If you'd like to get in touch with me, I can be reached at Twitter at Gene Cato, or by email at GeneCato@NextStagePress.net, and feel free to follow Next Stage Press on Twitter at Next Stage Press, or on our Facebook page at NS Press Podcast. So join us next time when we'll talk to New York playwright Penny Jackson about writing about cyberbullying and her play I Know What Boys Want. Until then, keep writing plays, keep reading plays, and keep going to the theater and supporting new work.